I'm journalist Angela Kenneke, and I'm grieving out loud after losing my 21-year-old daughter, Emily, to fentanyl poisoning.
I was a drug distributor, illicit drug distributor, and methamphetamine was my product.
Former drug dealer Scott Silverman now helps families in crisis navigate the road to recovery. The California man is also author of the book, The Opioid Epidemic: What You Don't Know Will Destroy Your Family and Your Life. I have a frank conversation with Scott about the public health crisis involving fentanyl.
And now, because the methamphetamine manufacturers, I'm going to put this in business terms, don't want to lose the market share to fentanyl, they're lacing their products with fentanyl. And then you have to ask the question, why would someone sell a product that would kill its consumers?
Scott is a crisis coach and family navigator and runs a recovery center in San Diego. He has advice for families dealing with someone in active addiction in this episode. Scott, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Grieving Out Loud. I'm excited to talk to you because I know we have a lot of parents that find my podcast who are searching for answers. And I think one of the things that you specialize in is helping families. So I want to start by talking a little bit about your background, how you got into this field in the first place.
That's a great question. My background really has nothing to do with what I'm doing today, other than experientially and anecdotally. I was one of those kids in my family. I was the black sheep, and I got connected with mood altering substances at a very young age. You know, I had a pretty much traditional family. There were four kids, parents worked hard, provided well, you know, there was structured love, if you will, in our family. And I just took a trajectory to a different area. And when I got under the influence, I found myself able to cope with a variety of different things. I shape it differently now. In those days, it was just like, this feels good and that doesn't, so I want to feel better. So I did those things. And, you know, fast forwarding, I kind of crashed and burned and got clean and sober in 1984, November 13th. That's actually my sobriety date. So I'll be coming up, I think it's 38 years. It's a year continuous sobriety. So what that does for me is it allows me to be able to tell others that there is hope and help, and it can be done. I run a treatment center now, certified and licensed in the state of California. We work with a lot of professionals. We work with young people. Have to be 18 and over because we're an adult facility. And one of our focuses right now is on veterans, which is unfortunately a very underserved population. And we're in San Diego, where the third largest veteran population exists, and half our veterans don't even have insurance. So Confidential Recovery is my treatment center. And I also do interventions, crisis coaching, and family navigating is something I like to call it that, because I think, you know, families call and they go, how do we fix this? Families were to call and say to you, I think my son has diabetes. Can you fix it? Well, no, but I can certainly make a suggestion that you see a doctor, you get an assessment, let him do the evaluation, and know that there are tools that one can use to manage it. And I look at this disease of addiction as a disease. But what I'm seeing in the last 10 years is young people, you know, who go to a party, go to a social event, and ending up taking a pill that's laced with fentanyl, and they expire. And unfortunately, you've had that experience. I don't know the details, but that's what I see more of. I mean, it's interesting. Today, San Diego just declared the fentanyl opioid issue a public health epidemic.
It's horrible that it took so long, but at least someone's doing that. They're not doing that in my community. We get a bad batch of drugs, or we get a bunch of drugs containing fentanyl, a bunch of overdoses. I think every community should declare a public health emergency, but they don't.
It's interesting because I actually went to our public health director 4 years ago, and I know the timing of it because it was 2 years before the pandemic. And I said, how do we do that? And in the 4 years that's passed, our overdose rate from opioids alone is well over 800%. So San Francisco declared a state of emergency about 2 months ago. I've been trying to reach the mayor. You know, there is such denial, in my opinion, that the public sector and the gubernatorial leadership and legislative leaders, they take it on sometimes as a campaign piece. Unless they've been impacted by it personally, then it's a challenge. I mean, a challenge for them to send the message out. But it has gotten to a point that over the last 10 years, it is just, it's remarkable, you know, how far we've gotten. And I actually heard on an interview yesterday that they're calling it the new D, weapons of mass destruction, fentanyl. It's up to 80% of the illicit drugs in our state. And that's based on testing criminals when they're arrested with what they get, they take to the lab or autopsies from the medical examiner. So it's not like they're fluffing the data. They don't have to, but up to 80% is laced with fentanyl.
It strikes me that when you were using, the threat of death wasn't so imminent.
Not at all. Example, methamphetamine, and I'm a retired, unlicensed pharmacist.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you smiled, so you probably have a good idea. Unlicensed pharmacist. I was a drug distributor, illicit drug distributor, and methamphetamine was my product. So I come at this when I work with people, and I talk about it in my book, The Opioid Epidemic. My experience is kind of unique because A, I'm in recovery. B, I was a distributor, and C, I've learned a ton of information becoming a provider and working with addiction professionals over the last few decades in recovery. So I've got that aspect of my experience that I can bring to the table, which, and according to science, 15% of our country has an addiction problem, 10% will seek help. And of the 10% that seek help that don't follow up with the initial programmatic support that they get in treatment, 95% of them will relapse. I mean, think about an industry that has a 95% failure rate. So we know it's bad. And, you know, as a subject matter expert, I can speak to it from a variety of different levels. So as somebody who was doing that back in the day, methamphetamine had about, I'm going to use simple terms, 8 or 9% purity proportion to how it was being made. And it was about $11,000 a pound. And I'm just focused on Southern California now. It gets more expensive as it leaves the Mexican super labs where it's manufactured most of the time. Now, today, you can actually go find a pound of methamphetamine. It's $1,100, 10 times less, and it's over 80% pure. So that's part of the problem, is the purity of the drugs, because, you know, obviously the technology's changed, people have gotten smarter, and the more addictive it is and the more potent it is, the better it is for the manufacturers and distributors and the, you know, the dealers, basically. So that's a piece of what's happened. And now, because the methamphetamine manufacturers don't want to, I'm going to put this in business terms, don't want to lose the market share to fentanyl, they're lacing their products with fentanyl.
Why do the drug dealers lace everything with fentanyl? And I say, well, one of the reasons is that it's cheap and easy and it gets people addicted fast if they survive.
There's a common understanding that fentanyl is a poison and the morbidity rate continues and people are on the news about the overdose. And then you have to ask the question, why would someone sell a product that would kill its consumers? And I've heard this probably 100 times in the criminal justice side of this, you know, law enforcement, because they interview and they get this information back. They don't care.
The line's out the door.
Exactly. And not only that, the line's out the door because when it hits the news, people who haven't thought about it are now engaging in being a new consumer. And so for them, morbidity is a marketing tool that you could never find a way to develop. And I'm trying to frame it in a way where people are going, wait. That makes no sense. Well, actually think about it. Yes, it does. You know, the key to marketing is make something that people need and have to replace often. I mean, that's the sales basis. One of the first, you know, commandments of sales. That's how you build a business. And there are people who, you know, have billion-dollar infrastructures that see. And by the way, we're the consumer. United States is the major consumer. So it's not hard to figure out where they need to bring their products.
I have parents contact me every week, struggling with a child, sometimes an adult child, sometimes a teenager, and they don't know what to do and they don't know where to turn. And maybe they've been willing to go to treatment. Maybe they're not willing to go to treatment. It's such a precarious time because if you have a loved one who's using, their chances of dying are really, really, really high. And I suppose over the years, the advice you give to parents when you help families navigate these systems has changed.
Well, I want to take your last statement. I want to split it into two parts. A child, you know, whether they're 17 or 37 or 47, sometimes, you know, they act like a child with the type of choices they're making that particular person who's consuming on a regular basis is probably not as high as risk as a 17 or 18 or 19 year old who's never experimented and has really no understanding of what it is they're about to put in their body. So that being said, I tell the same story to both sets of parents. One, they both have to get educated. I mean, if you were talking about somebody who got a form of cancer in your family, you do everything you can to research it, find out what the best resources are, the best treatment for it, the best doctors, the best facilities. You do all that. And you wouldn't even question what it took to find out. Second, once you gather that information, you really need to talk to somebody about how to talk to your loved one. Because the person who calls me is not the person who's actively using. That's pretty rare, unless they're handcuffed to a gurney in the ER at the hospital. Then I get those people. They call me then because they, see me on TV or their mother gave my number, blah, blah. But it's usually the family and they have no idea what to do. I mean, where in the family parenting book of knowledge does this come up? It's not even a chapter. It's not even a byline. It's not even in there.
I'm a journalist and I know how to research things. And when the trouble, I call it, with my daughter started in high school, and I took her from counselor to counselor to counselor, I invoked the law, I tried everything, but finding good information was really tough back then. I don't know if it's getting any easier.
And I think when you say back then, you're talking roughly, 5 years ago?
Yeah, well, 5 to 10 years ago.
Things have improved, but I think, again, the statistics I shared with you before about the failure rate, that hasn't changed. And that hasn't changed in 25 years. And part of the reason is the disease of denial. It's the inability to feel feelings. And most people who suffer from continuous self-medication or anesthetizing themselves, I like to say, they don't think they have a problem. So the person who has the problem, first of all, doesn't think they have the problem. And it's usually the family who's trying to advocate for them without a skill set, without the knowledge, without a compass, without a GPS. And what happens is, in many cases, that pushes that loved one to kind of camouflage their behavior and hide it differently. Because most people that know that they're taking something to feel better or to remove the pain have a pretty good idea that what they're doing isn't right. And they don't want to embarrass their family. They don't want their family to think ill of them. They don't want people to think that they're failing. So what happens is that kind of internal thinking compounds the problem. But so doing an intervention on it is hard because your customer doesn't think they have a problem.
That would be my daughter to a T. Like, she hit it. I didn't even know the extent. I mean, I knew she was doing something. I knew about marijuana. I didn't know the extent. And she was very ashamed. She knew it wasn't right. And she didn't want me to know. She didn't want to disappoint her mom.
Well, because she didn't want you to think she had a problem, number one. And number two, what she was doing was making her feel good in a way she never got from you or any other human being. And it didn't make sense to her. But she knew what she was doing probably wasn't right. So she wasn't going to come to you and go, "Hey, mom, you know what? I think the dosing of, the kind of drugs I'm doing today, I'd like to discuss with you because I want to make sure that I'm not hurting myself." That kind of conversation, unfortunately, never takes place. So let me go back to your question. So I think what parents need to do, God gave us two ears and one mouth. They have to listen. They have to learn. I mean, like this new concept, acronym I've come up with, because everybody likes PIE, prevent, inform, and educate. And my favorite is, toss up between pecan and apple. So the idea of that, the prevention piece, in my opinion, is two part. You have to really get educated and understand what's going on and know that, if you're 47 years old and you've got a 17 year old, you're probably not going to relate to everything that's going on in their world. And what's happening with social media, I think their studies are coming around now showing that you think of major influencers, my ilk, entertainment, music people, spiritual leaders, leaders in government, corporate, leadership, people have been successful. They're kind of like our thought leaders. Well, social media has become a thought leader platform, and it doesn't really matter who's pushing the information out. If it's been designed in a way to attract, people pick up on it. And then kids don't usually talk to each other about the experimentation of drugs. What they talk about is, you know, I tried this stuff and it was unbelievable. And that kind of triggers the mind to say, well, that if that made my good buddy feel good, and I'm already probably feeling pretty good, I could feel even better. How do you get into that mindset? I mean, and really talk to somebody. And, you know, as somebody who's been through it, all I can do is share my experience, strength, and hope. And I've learned over time that if I can get someone to listen a little bit, and they don't know me, but build a level of trust, and I can generally do it pretty quickly, then I can listen to them. And if they feel they're being heard, sometimes we get lucky and they might pivot. But a lot of times, you know, when I get involved, I call it the shut up meeting. You know, the kids want to shut up their parents. So they take the meeting. So it's even difficult. And I'm 68 years old. They see me and I, you know, what would you know? And then they check my bio and realize, oh my God, look where this guy's been. But it is difficult. And I wish I could tell you there's an easy 1, 2, 3 step that one can take.
When we were preparing for that intervention, I was really afraid. I thought, this is not going to work. She's going to walk out. She's not going to go to treatment. I mean, do you think interventions work?
Again, if somebody is not ready to hear the message, I mean, I don't even do traditional interventions anymore. I mean, I do most of my work through Zoom, so I can talk to families anywhere in the country or the world. And I think that traditional, everyone sitting in a circle and sharing how they love somebody, sometimes can take the person who's already on a journey of shame-based feelings and amplify it. And then they go, oh my God, you know, my parents, for example, have now brought all my siblings and my cousins into a room. I was trying to keep this a secret. They feel betrayed.
That's really interesting. I never looked, but I understand that.
Well, it's worse for moms because you're the mom, you know, you're the mom. And the thing that's interesting, and I every time I talk to families, I go, do you know the difference between you and me? And they go, well, you're an expert. I said, no, there's something even more simpler. I'm not family. I could say the same thing to their child that they say, but I'm not family. And when it comes from family, because keep in mind, you're the one who loved your child. You're the one who did whatever you could to put the things underneath them and in front of them to try to make their life easy. So you're the first person that's probably going to get in their head the information last. You're never going to be the first person. You'll be the last person because they don't want to disappoint. So that's why getting information, turning to a third party, talking to an expert, if you can find one in your community. And you're right, they're hard. Traditional therapy doesn't look at addiction the same way until it's been diagnosed. And you can't deal with underlying behavioral health issues if somebody's under the influence. You have to remove that first. It's almost like you have to get undressed before you go in the shower because it won't work if you don't.
Right. And it's just such a complicated thing for families to navigate all of this.
Complicated and opaque, meaning there is no one remedy and there is no
right.
And there's no vaccination for it, which is why it makes it so difficult. And I think that contributes, you know, to this industry's outcomes. And I say industry because I'm in it. But on the other hand, you know, we have clients that we can work with for 90 days, maybe even 6 months. I mean, and the way treatment's paid for is it's benefits driven, which is a problem.
It's a huge problem.
A 3 to 5 year known issue in 30 days. And when most people go into inpatient programs, most people, they learn new tips and tricks. I can't tell you how much I've heard in the last 4 years where kids have gone in for methamphetamine addiction and they've come out a heroin addict. Well, how did that happen? Because the people inside there suffer from the same disease. And after group, they're talking to each other on what they can do for survival skills. You know, it's interesting. And I learned that. I used to work with people coming out of jail and prison. And I've learned from them how they survive. And there was only one skill they needed in prison, and that was to survive. So when you think about it, the form of institutionalization, obviously they had criminogenic think as well. But when people are in this environment, they're going to do certain things they have to do to survive. Because if you don't, you don't survive.
So because it's so complicated and because not the same thing works for every person, and I know you wrote the book on the opioid epidemic. So what do you see as some of the solutions here? You started talking about pie, but how do we start, you know, moving the needle on the success rate, on bringing down the number of deaths, on getting families the help that their loved one needs.
I recently had an epiphany. And at my age, having an epiphany is so exciting. I think we have to reverse engineer the way we think. I think we have to reverse market this issue. For example, a simple one, Narcan, I'm learning about, is the opioid overdose reversal drug. It's not in most schools. So by introducing that kind of a tool, it's kind of like I was thinking the other night, well, you know, seatbelts weren't always on cars. Smoke detectors weren't always in homes. Fire extinguishers weren't always in garages. Something had to happen for that to be mandated to take place. And when you think about it, what was that? Look at the effort that was put in to the pandemic. And I think until we see this as that we, and it's the euphemistic we, I mean, I don't trust the government's going to fix this problem. You know, there's a lot of communities now that are going to get large sums of money because of the settlements with Purdue and the company and the opioid settlements. And a lot of that's going to go to law enforcement. A lot of it's going to go to the county municipalities and the treatment providers, the people on the ground. They're probably not going to see a lot of that. So we can use Narcan, which is a tool to help, you know, overdose reversing. But while we're introducing it, we talk about why we're introducing it. This particular medication has been created because who knows in the room? Oh, because my mom said I should carry it, a nasal spray in case my friend overdosed. Well, and have those conversations, whether it's at school with the family. And look, I know from what we've seen in our school system, asking a teacher to do one more thing is just brutal. And it's almost unfair. And the schools are, they have our children for, you know, a few hours every day. So there's some consistency that can be embedded. Maybe more resources for the school, get specialists, whatever that base is, whether it's faith-based, a service club, you know, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, and I'm just, you know, randomizing ideas, or the family. If I had to pick a group, I would trust the family first.
Emily's Hope is developing educational curriculum, prevention curriculum, and we're piloting it in August for elementary school in an age-appropriate way where we're teaching kids about the brain and what substances do to the brain, because I and my committee and everybody who's helped me with this feels strongly that we're not doing enough of that right now, especially at the younger ages. We wait till kids are in middle school, high school to talk about prevention. It's too late. It's too late because peers become much more of an influence than parents and teachers. And so we're working really hard on this prevention piece. I hope it makes a difference. And I hope it's in every school eventually.
Well, and if I could make a suggestion is, make sure, if you can, whoever's going to deliver that information, the kids are able to relate to. Whether it's a 14-year-old skateboarder or a 15-year-old swimming expert or someone who plays tennis or rides horses or, you know, someone who's got a platform that can help deliver the message. I just believe that if you don't go peer-to-peer, you're going to have difficulty with kids getting engaged. I know, and I get criticized for saying this, but the DARE program is one of the only.
It didn't work.
And that's what I get criticized for. Scott's the only one out there. Well, but yeah, but when they took it to rural areas, you know, kids were learning more. It's kind of like when I was saying earlier, they go into treatment, they learn more tips and tricks. So, but kids are pretty smart today. So if they can get the message out in a way where it's being delivered by somebody, the kid's going to go, whoa, did you hear what so-and-so just said? Because they're not going to say, hey, our math teacher now is giving drug talks. So my point is, that's important, the delivery system. And, you know, look, by the way, I'm going to extend an olive branch. If I can help, you know, in any way, shape, or form, I spent 3 years developing the book and I used a co-writer who did a lot of the research and spoke to a lot of different people. And if there's nuggets in there that you could utilize, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And
no,
contemporized information coming from somebody whose agenda is to stop going to funerals.
What else do you have in the book that you think it's important? And we'll put a link to your book.
It's a toolbox, how to ask questions, how to listen, what to look for, what the symptoms look like, you know, what's changing in your child's life, or, you know, are there new people coming into the house and jewelry's missing, you know, simple things that people wouldn't necessarily think about. Also how to stop, take a deep breath and know that you can't fix this.
Yeah.
You cannot fix this. You are the parent. And as the parent, you must be the steward and the navigator. But if you don't know how, it's okay to ask for help. Three of the hardest words in the English language is, I need help. So that's really where I start with people is I ask them to be quiet, take a few deep breaths. I want you to try to get to the facts, what's going on. And then let's back into what's important about what you could do tonight, tomorrow, the next day to start the process. You know, you're not going to create systemic change overnight, but part of how you even communicate with a child could be part of the intervention. And sometimes that communication is shutting up. You know, where were you tonight? You know, I went into your room. I saw your vaping pipe. I know you're doing drugs. Well, the more a parent does that, the smarter the kid's going to get, and they're going to hide their stuff out of where the parents find it.
I think parents in those instances, because I've been there, are truly acting out of fear. Like, we are just afraid that something is going to happen to our kid and it's out of our control. They're not toddlers anymore.
But I'm a firm believer, if the house is on fire and you bring a squirt gun, you might feel like you're doing something you need to do to help prevent the house from burning down. I get it, but the squirt gun's not going to do it. And that to me is more my analogy with government. I mean, they tend to bring a squirt gun to a fire and it's just not working. It's got to be on the table, just like fruits, vegetables, protein, water.
Right. Don't you think the reason it's not at that point? I mean, we're in our little corners of the world talking about it. I hear from more and more parents every day because the overdose numbers or deaths are through the roof. I think it's the stigma that holds everybody back here and that stops society from accepting that addiction is a disease of the brain.
I agree. Absolutely agree. It is a stigma. And then if we start talking about it, in some ways, we're revealing that we have this defect in our family.
But everybody has it in their family somewhere. Well, you know,
one in five is the number now. But on the other hand, every family has some. Look, you live long enough, you're going to get every disease, they say. So if you look at it like diabetes and we don't camouflage it or candy coat it, and mostly we deny it. We just go, you know, we will love them and they'll be fine. Well, how long have you been working at that? Well, 6 years. And how's that working for you? Well, it's not. So if it doesn't work, maybe you need to change it.
Do you think because of the fentanyl and the drug supply that families should take maybe extreme measures to try to save their loved one's life?
Absolutely. Why wouldn't one? But
like what? What would you suggest that they do?
Well, you can't put your kid in a cocoon. You can't put them in a bubble. I think the best way, the simplest way of all the things we talked about today is when the parent sits down with a child. First of all, you put the finger of shame away. Second of all, you put the finger of accusations away. Even if you know that they know you know, telling them doesn't help. That just makes them feel like they got caught. So sit down and say, example, you know, hope somebody sees this podcast and say, you know, he said something interesting, or he didn't say something interesting, using third party, about what's going on right now with the overdoses in our country. What do you know? What are your friends talking about? What have you learned? Because it's your generation that seems to be getting impacted by this. Soft, quiet, and then shut up. And then what comes out of their mouth next will hopefully guide you to what you should do next. If I had to wrap this up in 30 seconds and say, that's a nugget I'd like to see you take away, try that. I had a mother once say to me, I'm moving, I've sold the house, I'm getting a trailer, I'm going out to the desert, taking my daughter with me, and I'm going to make sure I stay with her 24 hours a day. She had a methamphetamine addiction, and I know a lot about methamphetamine. I said to her, what are you going to do when you go to sleep? She says, what do you mean? I said, well, when you go to sleep, you don't think your daughter is potentially going to get on her hands and knees and crawl 3 or 4 miles to find some methamphetamine? What makes you say that? I said, because you told me she does those things. So I said, I don't understand how you think that's going to help. Well, if it's not around, she will find it. That's her job. If she's in a drug-seeking mode, she will find her medicine to make her feel better. And methamphetamine is one of the ones that are really tough because they don't have medication-assisted treatment and harm reduction for methamphetamine. Now, if it's cut or laced with fentanyl, they can treat the opioid side, but not really the methamphetamine. It's a detox that has to happen, hopefully medically supervised, and then treatment, and then outpatient, and then follow-up, and then some sort of engagement, long-term support.
So what did you tell that mother to do with her daughter rather than take her away into the desert? Or did she try that? Like, what happened?
Well, she said, would you talk to her? I said, I will talk to her. So I met with the kid. You know, she was, I don't know, maybe 20 years younger than me. We sat down and go, your mom wants to sell your house and move to the desert in a trailer. How excited are you about that? She said, I'm not going with her. I said, really? I said, so why is she willing to do that? She's crazy. I mean, she thinks I have a problem. And I took her. I said, look, let's go to the men's room for a second. Okay. And I put her in front of a mirror. And I said, what do you see? She had pot marks. And, you know, she was missing a couple teeth. And a lot of that from that. She said, I don't look very good, do I? I said, well, you know, I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to make the observation. You're a smart person. Let's go back and talk to your mom. Anyway, so we talked about her getting access to treatment and mom providing resources for her when she got out. I know mom didn't sell the house. They didn't get the trailer and they started communicating. I followed up with them for a couple months and we had some three-way conversations. And I think, you know, she was heading in the right direction. But, you know, you've got to make some major changes when you do things like that. I mean, I was lucky. I had my wife. She was with me in my last 2 years of using and my worst time. And she's been with me ever since. Without that family support, it's really hard. So when there's family involved, and then of course there is the situation where the accidental overdose, and I heard that term about 15 years ago. And I just thought, why? I don't believe that. I don't believe that. What does that mean? And then I learned it happens all the time. And you're right. Back in my day, and you know who said this was Dr. Drew, said when Whitney Houston passed away, an overdose, he was beside himself for 3 days all over the media going, you know, musicians, entertainers, famous people, rich people, poor people have been shooting heroin and smoking marijuana and crack cocaine, and they weren't overdosing and dying. And something's happened now. You know, a lot of it, you know, like Whitney, she had prescription anxiety medicine, she had cocaine, alcohol. It's the mix and the purity. And that's where I think we have to start educating children to know. There was a homeless guy in San Diego about 6 months ago, was interviewed by a reporter. He's been surviving for years. He was a methamphetamine addict. And he told the story how he goes, you know, it's dangerous out here now. Before it was uncomfortable. And now it's dangerous because the drugs that are on the streets are mixed with things that we can't find ways to test. So he goes, what I do with my methamphetamine before I put it in my body, because I want to live. This is a consuming active drug user. I got a hold of the fentanyl test strips and I test my methamphetamine every week. And I thought that was pretty sophisticated. So how do we teach kids to do that? Test something. If you're going to put it in your body, okay, we can't stop you.
Some people would say that was encouraging kids, but they're going to do it anyway, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's going to be people that say that. So if it's a tool that works, because Narcan's a reversing tool, a fentanyl test strip basically will allow someone to know if there's fentanyl in a drug they're taking. And since fentanyl is commonly a poison on the streets, how bad could it be? I mean, there was a billboard in San Francisco a couple months ago showing a couple friends going to a party and everybody had Narcan in their pocket. If you're going to party with a buddy, kind of like a designated overdose reversing colleague, I mean, okay, I thought it was crazy, but you know what? If it saved a life, why not? And I think we've got to get the test strips out there. We have to get Narcan in the schools. Narcan will save a life. A test strip may prevent somebody from taking poison that could kill them. So they're different uses, but they're applications that, how do we ignore those? What else is there? I mean, we've seen that, you know, here's your brain on drugs. If you're just say no.
Well, just say no didn't work.
Not at all. We haven't come up with a solution yet. So putting things out there that are helpful and it starts the conversation. For example, somebody wants to come into treatment with us. Okay. They're a marijuana smoker. They drink and they say, I'm not giving up marijuana. We let them in because to me, that's harm reduction, is to be able to say to somebody, look, we understand marijuana is your friend. Alcohol is your friend. You think only one of them's killing you. That's fine. That's your thought process, but come into treatment and let's start talking about what the path of abstinence might look like. And you know what? Most people given a choice will go, you know, that's fair. Nobody else would do that.
What have you found works best for treatment for people? Medically assisted treatment for opioids, I think, is essential. What's working for you, for people that you see?
Long-term support, meaning when I created Competition Recovery, the idea was we're going to get them for probably 60 or 90 days from the insurance company. Then we're going to try to create a back end where they're tethered to us for even once a week or even once every 2 weeks or once a month. So it's that continuum of care with the social model. And the social model really kind of came out of my experience with anonymous programs. And treatment-wise, I mean, there is, you know, harm reduction, there's methadone, there are people that think that it's synthetic heroin and people just move from one drug to another. But for some people, it really works well. But I'm a zero abstinence person to get people to. But if some people's taking medical marijuana because they have seizures when they try to stop drinking or using, it's a tool. So, you know, I just talked to a group the other day, said, what's your opinions on, you know, marijuana? I said, I just share with you. It's a tool if it works. You know, with ketamine, some people, that's a tool. Some people think psychedelics are a tool for detoxing. I don't necessarily believe in that because it's highly addictive. But I think the long-term commitment, the communication, the facilitation of a group, and people reporting back in, because we UA people, we test people. So there's accountability. I think that, to me, gives us the best shot at doing it. But I've seen people go away for 18 months, come back and get loaded within a week. So what we teach people is different things they can pick up, from meditation to yoga, to breathing, to, you know, to going to other 12-step meetings, non-12-step meetings, Buddhist meetings, faith-based groups, something to have that connectivity. An addict by themselves, like one of my favorite sayings is my mind is like a bad neighborhood. I try not to go there alone ever. I go to 4 meetings a week and I've been in recovery for 37 years. And I do it because Zoom is convenient. And secondly, I want to preserve the integrity of my recovery. And some people don't even like the word recovery. Some people don't like the word sobriety. Okay, it works for me. And we treat clients with the idea that one size doesn't fit all. So we meet them where they're at. We give them the basics of the education side of it. And then we try to tailor a lifestyle change for them that makes sense for them and fits for them. So it isn't something, I don't want to do that. Well, if someone says that, then they won't. Well, let's find something you will do. Because if what was working, we wouldn't be talking.
That's true. Well, thank you for all of your insight. And we will put links on the show notes for this podcast to your website and to your book. Really appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me for Grieving Out Loud. You can listen to more episodes of this podcast and read my blogs on our website, emilyshope.charity. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage.